On Talk Radio 98.5 and 1240 WRTA, it is WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen with us from Penn State Cooperative Extension horticulture educator Tom Butzler. Hello there.
Hey, thanks for having me on today, Doug.
And before I forget to mention it, you submitted one of these shows for some competition, and you got an award for it.
Yeah. So I belong to an association called the National Association of County Agriculture Agents, and they have several different award categories, for folks that are doing all kinds of work out there in the community, and you submit it. And I submitted this radio show / podcast to one of those entries, and we made it all the way up to the region. We didn't make it up to a national finalist, but this is judged by my peers, other county agriculture agents across the states, not just within Pennsylvania. We got out of the Pennsylvania competition, so we did very well there. But we were unable to get out of the we won the Northeast, but we weren't able to get to the next level. So I think it's a little bit of a testament to, I think the interesting conversation and banter we have on horticulture topics. At least that's the way I like to think of it.
Well, I look at it this way. I just ask questions. You have all the answers. So the award is yours and congratulations.
Well, I wouldn't say I have all the answers. A couple times you've stumped me with some questions. And
yeah, but you always come back and find out what the answer was if you didn't know. So congratulations on the award. And we posted that on our Facebook pages, the WRTA and the WRTA Weekend page. I'll also put it on the podcast of this program.
Oh, great. That's
picture,
cool.
So you can see that there. So the award's cool, and get them next year, and we go to national or whatever you want to do. And, we do one of these a month. Actually, we do 13 because sometimes we do an extra one for the Christmas plant show. So if Tom wants to submit something else, there you go. Got some to choose from. And by the way, if you have any questions for Tom, like he said, he can find the answers. So Doug at LightnerRadio.com, or he'll give his email address at the end, and that's also in the podcast if you want to email a question directly. We wanted to talk about a couple different things, and Tom suggested we start with tomato issues. I get the feeling that when you mention it that way, that there are a multitude of them this year.
Yeah, well, first off, Doug, when you look at anyone's vegetable garden, I think 99.9% of the time, the one vegetable plant or crop that everyone has in their garden is tomatoes. I mean, it's just kind of a favorite. And I think they're very versatile. A lot of people will grow Roma tomatoes to make sauces. Others grow those, large tomatoes for slicing for sandwiches. People like those cherry tomatoes for their salad. So it's a very popular plant to have in the garden. But we're starting to run into issues, as we do every year. It's just tomatoes are kind of a susceptible crop to a lot of issues. And the calls are starting to come into the office, and people are sending pictures. And so there's a whole litany of things that are occurring out there in the tomato garden, and I just wanted to touch upon a couple of them. And I think the biggest one right now, or at least the pictures that we get calls about, is blossom end rot. And this is where the part of the tomato that's furthest away from being attached to the plant, so the bottom of the tomato and the blossom end, it starts to rot away. And the scientists have determined it's because of a calcium issue, and calcium is integral to maintaining the cell wall integrity. And so oftentimes when people hear that, they think, well, I need to apply a fertilizer that contains more calcium, or I need to put a foliar spray of a fertilizer on the plants so they can absorb more calcium. And typically, Doug, most of our soils have adequate calcium. The calcium needs water to move around, into the root and up through that plant's plumbing system. And right now, plants are under a little bit of stress, or I guess it depends on where you are in the state. But when we have these soil moisture fluctuations, where it goes from very hot and dry weather conditions that dry out the soil, water tends to move a little less slowly. And so calcium is transported in this water rather readily, and it's not getting to the fruit. And so we get this rotting appearance on the tomato. So that's probably the biggest issue we see out there right now. Now, there's a couple other big ones, but before I go on to those, is that something you've ever seen in your garden, that blossom end rot?
Yeah, I haven't had a tomato for a couple of years, tomato plant for a couple of years, but I did have that as part of a problem because the one was just, it grew like a weed. I mean, I had an empty space because where I was living at the time, I had a flower garden for several years and a very successful one, and they decided they were going to put something in there to keep things from germinating. So after about 2 or 3 weeks of waiting, I went and said, did you guys spray anything? Oh, yeah, so you won't get any weeds. I also won't get any flowers. Thank you. But later in the season, somebody gave me a tomato plant, and I put that in. Whatever it was had dissipated by that time because, boy, did this thing take off. It covered the entire space of what was the flower bed, and I tried to stake it, but it was just so huge. I don't know. Maybe all the fertilizer I'd put there over the years finally found a home in this plant, but it just grew big, and some of the stuff would get the end rot, and the stuff I was able to keep up and away was not as bad. Strangely, the tomatoes that were lower on the plant, and it's hard to say lower since it spread out so much and I was trying to prop it up, the tomatoes on the plant that were lower had less of a problem than the ones that were higher and further up the plant, if that makes any sense?
Well, it could. I mean, you know, those flowers are setting at different times, so that fruit could have set earlier when it was cooler and growing when it was a little cooler. I'm not saying like springtime temperatures. And then you get into, you know, the hotter part of the growing season, it could have put some stress on it. So, yeah, I mean, that we see that. Usually when you see blossom end rot, it's not on every tomato on a plant.
Yeah, that's what got me, because some of them were fine and some of them were not. And, of course, if something touched the ground, well, you figure that if you didn't get it in time because it was buried under foliage, you probably weren't going to be able to use that one or salvage that particular tomato. But the ones I got off it were good. I paid nothing for the plant. It grew and it was fantastic. Oh, yeah. So, you know, it was a win-win for everything.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we talk about blossom end rot, and there is a solution. It's my favorite topic if anyone's been listening to the show over the past couple years. And basically, it's mulching. If you can put down a layer of mulch so that the soil moisture under that mulch is there for long periods of time, that really alleviates the stress, the water stress issue on tomatoes. We see this more often with tomato plants that are grown in bare soil. Just basically, you know, someone planted them in the soil and, you know, they'll weed around the plant and they'll occasionally water it, but that soil is exposed. Mm. And so you have rapid loss of water. So one way to alleviate that loss of water is that layer of mulch. Could be, you know, black plastic, or it could be a couple inches of straw. I use grass clippings. So, you know, however you do it, but that mulching does really, I'm not going to say eliminate, but it does tend to reduce the amount of blossom end rot you get on your tomatoes.
Well, I would just ask you to clarify how much is too much, because I've seen some people just pile mulch on to it's almost a mountain around a tree, and I've seen them mulch the garden, and I'm thinking, you're not just keeping out the weeds, you're killing off half the stuff you planted. So how do you tell people to do it?
Yeah, that's a good question, an observation, because I do think people fail to realize that roots breathe. There is an exchange of gases that occur down in those roots in the soil. And so if you put excessive amounts of mulch, like 6-8 inches, that's going to conserve moisture. Yeah, it's going to choke out those weeds, but you're really putting those roots deeper under the soil. I mean, they're under a layer of mulch too now, and that's just not the way they were designed or evolved over time. You know, they do need to be close to the soil surface, and they need to be able to access and get rid of gases. So, you know, in the garden, depending on what kind of mulch you use, you know, 2 to 3 inches would be fine. If you're using black plastic, of course, that's very, very thin. We're talking millimeters. It just serves as a barrier, and you have, reduced water loss. So it depends on the type of mulch you're using. But, you know, I like to use organic stuff that's going to decompose over time. So I might use shredded leaves, or I might use grass clippings. But, you know, 2 to 3 inches most. And that's usually enough to prevent that loss of water out of the soil.
When you say black plastic, you mean just the sheets of plastic that you would use as a weed barrier usually. But you've got it so that the plants can grow through it. As you put it down. The thing is, I don't want people to confuse that with like a rubberized mulch or something when you're talking about plastic.
No. So, you know, in commercial agriculture, you know, a lot of times they don't have access to large amounts of organic matter that they could spread over 10 acres, 20 acres, you know, of tomatoes or pumpkins or whatever it is. So a lot of these commercial growers utilize black plastic because, you know, you can buy it in bulk. It's very thin.
The sheets of it, sure.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so and they just poke holes in it and they put in their transplants or they seed in it and it comes up. And so, yeah, it works real well. I mean, the one big issue we're starting to see more and more of is a disposal issue. But there is a lot of research going on looking at biodegradable mulches that might be made of a paper and a glue substance that it stays intact for several months or, you know, half the summer, and then it starts to degrade. So there's a lot of research going on.
Yeah, so then when you're done with it, it's no longer needed. It's no longer a problem either. It's dissipated and it's not hurt the soil.
Yes. So, you know, that research has been going on for a while. There's some technical barriers there, but it is an issue when you have just straight plastic mulch on disposal. So hopefully, you know, that's the purpose of land-grant universities such as Penn State to investigate this, do the research, do the science, do the field trials, and find out what works and what doesn't. So there are some biodegradable products that are coming onto the market that are pretty good, and you're starting to see some adoption of that technology.
When you put down the black plastic, and it uses as a weed barrier, not necessarily as the mulch. I've got some stones around part of the house, and it had plastic under it. I know that from seeing the way it was done years ago. But some of that's starting to wear, I'm suspecting, because I haven't dug everything up. But you could also have weed seeds that just lodge in the stones, and then you're going to get a few weeds that way, right? It may not be the plastic.
Absolutely. So, you know, something, any of those organic, those weed barriers, those synthetic weed barriers that don't decompose, they're really good for the first couple years. But over time, dirt kind of falls on top or leaves, and then they degrade, and it serves as a media for weed seeds to germinate and grow. So, yeah, you could have weeds that will germinate on top of that black plastic, and then you have a weed problem again. So I like, at least in the landscape, I like using organic material, basically mulch. It looks good, and you know, it does, as it decomposes, it adds some organic matter to the soil. The only disadvantage to that is that, you know, you got to apply a layer of mulch every year or two because it's decomposing, because it loses its color. So I think ultimately, Doug, is that any mulch you use or practice you use, there's going to be some pros and cons. And you kind of have to weigh those to see what works best for you, your practices, your pocketbook. You know, so, you know, those are some things you just have to investigate a little bit.
And also, I think if you go to the garden center and you ask some people for advice, hey, I've got this problem here. You don't have Tom Butzler standing right there next to you, but so you can ask these people. Now, admittedly, if it's some, not all of the big box stores, some, not all the employees are going to go, I have no idea, because they just got moved from hardware or something. But there are a lot of people that are knowledgeable at these garden centers who can give you a few pointers along those lines for something specific, I guess.
Yeah, so, you know, a couple of points there. You know, sometimes it depends on who's on the job that day. The background and training they've had is kind of, you have alluded to a little bit. But the other thing is, you know, Penn State and other land-grant universities, they have plenty of fact sheets out there, and I can provide you one that you can put up and your viewers can look at it.
Great.
On mulching, and you know, some of the pros and cons and advantages and disadvantages. And so, you know, there are resources out there that you can look at online, read or whatever, and then go to the garden store and talk to somebody and have a conversation with them. It may be, and it's not a debate. You don't want to put, you know, denigrate anybody, but you just kind of go back and forth and see what they have to say and kind of weigh that upon what you've read on these fact sheets.
You know, it's interesting when you put stuff down, like I expanded a flower bed a few years ago, and I put the cardboard down and the soil on top of it to let it. And unfortunately, there were a few small pieces of cellophane tape that were still on the cardboard from the shipping box. And that won't be that much of a problem. It's like I'm still pulling pieces of those out a couple of years later when I'm digging through everything and cultivating. So you got to be careful on that. But I'm thinking where I do have a few small spaces where I have the stones there and I've started to get a few weeds. The worst I could do is I just take everything out and, you know, dust it off and get rid of any more seeds that might be growing in there. Or if it needs a new application of black plastic, if it started to break up, I could just put one down, put the stones back on it, and there you go.
So you mentioned stones, and we'll have to come back to tomatoes because there's a lot more to talk about.
Oh, okay. We'll do a whole second segment on tomatoes then.
Okay. But I did want to make a comment about the stones. And this is something I probably have to look into a little more. But here's one of the disadvantages, I think, of stones, and I think it's going to be more problematic as we go on into the future, is those stones, yeah, they look nice, and you can put a plastic underneath, and you put the stones on top, and it acts as a weed barrier. But these stones, you know, if we get these hot, sunny days, these stones are going to absorb that heat. And then at night, they're emitting that heat back up to the plants that are surrounding them. So, you know, just like humans, you know, we need the night after very hot days to kind of cool down a little bit, just to our bodies just kind of relax and recuperate from that hot heat we've just been exposed to. So with rock around the landscape, you've got these trees and shrubs that are being bombarded with these intense sun rays during the day, and they have the ability to cool off. They evaporate, you know, they bring water up to their leaves and it evaporates, and that's a cooling process. But at night, typically, it's a chance for the plant to maybe basically catch up and recover a little bit. But with these stones, they get bombarded with this intense sun, and then those rocks get warm, and then they're emitting that heat throughout the night. And so these plants are exposed to this heating time period much longer. So I think that's one of the aspects of rock mulch that people probably have to look at. You know, if it's part of the house that gets shade in the afternoon, rocks won't be a big deal. But if it's the front yard that gets 8 hours of sunlight in the summer, you know, there's some plants that are not going to do real well. So, for example, dogwoods. Dogwoods, our native tree.
Yeah.
Its native habitat is in a forest setting under trees, an understory tree. So having it out in the middle of a landscape with rocks around it, that's pretty tough.
Yeah, you know, it's something I had totally not even considered, although I have to wonder why it doesn't do that and kill the dang weeds.
So, yeah.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen. We have with us horticulture educator Tom Butzler from Penn State Cooperative Extension, the award-winning, by the way, if you missed the beginning of the show. And we'll have a podcast up later if you did, and you'll see what we're talking about. But since I'm Mr. Tangent here and I took us away from where Tom was talking, you said there was a lot more you wanted to discuss about tomatoes. Go for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, blossom end rot we talked about in the earlier segment. But there's a couple other things to be aware with tomatoes. You know, I've talked also in the past that tomatoes are warm-loving plants. I mean, they love the heat. But there is a range where, it is detrimental to the plant. And so when we get into these really hot temperatures, the pollen of the tomatoes, it doesn't move around as well. We get poor pollination when we reach those really hot days, you know, 95, 100 degrees, and where the nights are not cool, you know, where those nights don't get below 80 degrees. You know, they might be 79, 81 degrees. So when we have those hot days followed by kind of warm nights, or you could say hot nights, the plants start aborting their flowers. And so you may not notice it right away because you're not out in the garden every day or you're not looking at the flowers, but several weeks later you'll be scratching your head thinking, why am I have a gap in tomatoes coming off of my plant? And so if you would backtrack, you could see, several weeks earlier we had a heating event and those flowers did not set. Now, in that case, there's not really anything you can do. That's just what nature throws at us, unless you were growing these tomatoes in a structure and you could put on air conditioning and so forth. But in that case, I would just go to the farmer's market and buy my own tomatoes.
Yeah.
So that's just something to be aware of, that you know, if we get into these hot stretches, you might get some poor pollination. And that occurs in a lot of our vegetable plants. With pumpkins, and we'll come back to tomatoes real quick, but I just want to mention with pumpkins, that pollen is really heavy, and so it's not wind-blown, right? And the way pumpkin pollen, cucumbers, butternut squash, all that pollen in that family is very heavy. So it's not – the wind doesn't move it around. What moves it around are insects. So they go from the female or the male flower, pick up some pollen, and they go to the female flower. When we have really hot days, our pollinators they're going to go find a swimming pool or something. You know, they're going to go lounge by the swimming pool, kind of rest and relax. They're not as active because it's tough out there. And so they're not as active, and we'll get poor pollination because of those heat events. And I've seen that. And then the other thing on that, since we're on pumpkins, I'll come back to tomatoes. I'm sorry, Doug, is that on cucurbits, such as pumpkins, when it's really hot, you get the overproduction of male flowers at the expense of female flowers. So, and I have seen that in some pumpkin fields where there's hardly any crop. And part of the reason is that when the female flowers are supposed to be popping up, all we were getting was male flowers. And we just had these extremely hot temperatures. So it's just something to be aware of. And maybe our plant breeders can work something out where they're going to breed plants that are better able to withstand some of these hot temperatures.
Better balance and better temperature. Here's something I'm wondering. When I was a kid, I think I talked about this a long time ago, we had these balsam flowers, and we didn't have any purple. And I was looking at my school textbook, elementary school textbook, and it talked about how flowers work. So what I did was I got one of these little paintbrushes, and I went around and cross-pollinated a bunch of them. And the next year, we had a ton of purple ones. Now, if you don't have enough of the female, it's not going to matter anyway, but if you and I don't know whether if I was a commercial farming operation, I might even try to find some way to do this. If you were going to go out and manually pollinate it, cross pollinate everything with a brush or some such device, do they do that?
So on a commercial scale, there's not much that people go around and hand pollinate, other than greenhouse tomatoes. They'll go, you know, because usually field tomatoes, you have wind that's moving those flowers around, the pollen drops out, and you know, you get it onto the female structure of the flower. So wind takes care of those field tomatoes. But in greenhouse tomatoes, there's not much wind up there because, you know, it's enclosed. So there are a couple ways to get some air movement or the flowers to move a little bit. And one of them is they go around with this little tool that vibrates, and you put it up against the flower, and you trigger it, and it vibrates, and it shakes the flower, and the pollen moves around a little bit. So, you know, that's one way kind of to hand pollinate on a commercial scale. They're not using the paintbrush method as you're talking about. But plant breeders, yes, just kind of doing what you did as a young kid you were talking about there, is, you know, if they want to make certain crosses, they know the exact male, and they want to put it on a specific female, they will take a paintbrush or something similar, and, you know, go get that the pollen from the male and then take it over to the female flower or a part of the flower, because that's they're controlling it. They're not relying on just random wind event. They're not relying on pollinators to move things around, because who knows what kind of pollen or, you know, what, you know, the parent a lineage. They don't, you know, unsure of what the pollinators are doing. So you can control breeding when you do it yourself. You know exactly what plant that male pollen's coming from and what plant is the female. So, yeah, they do that a lot on plant breeding.
And I should emphasize, when I talk about a paintbrush, I use one of the brushes that I would have used for a model car kit. So we're talking a tiny thing to do something like that. That's what I'm thinking on a commercial scale. It would be just astronomically difficult to do that. And I didn't know that they had the deal that they can knock the pollen loose with that. So it's several things we learned today that we've never heard before because of Tom Butzler. Anything else about the tomatoes before we leave that?
I haven't even touched upon some of the disease issues that we're getting calls in. Did you want to wait to the next segment on that?
No. We got time on this one. Everybody pull up a seat. We'll just sit here and we'll learn more about tomatoes, because, quite frankly, I might actually try to grow some again next season after all this.
Okay. So the big issue is Septoria leaf spot and early blight. These are disease organisms that reside or live in our soils. And, you know, once we get into the growing season, this fungus grows and it sporulates, and it just starts it starts throwing its spores up on the leaf, and so on the leaves of the plant. And since these are soil-borne organisms, this disease starts on the lower leaves, and then it just gradually works its way up. And so Septoria leaf spot, it's just these tiny little lesions on the leaf, whereas early blight also starts as tiny little lesions, but then they grow larger. And it grows like a bullseye. Now, it's a little irregular shape. It's not a perfect circle. But you have this kind of bullseye-like pattern with those lesions. And so, you know, there are a couple things you can do. Right now, it's a little too late. But you can start out with tomatoes that are resistant to these diseases. So, that, you know, you wouldn't want to go to a garden center or order your seeds from, you know, varieties that are resistant to it. Or the other thing is to apply some sort of a fungicide. And, you know, there are some organic options that give you a little bit of control. And then there are some synthetic options that give you a higher level of control of this disease. Now, these diseases aren't that fast moving unless, Doug, we run into an extended rainy spell, you know, where we're getting several days of rain and cloud cover. And these leaves stay wet, especially these leaves that are kind of in the interior of the plant. They're shaded, so they don't dry off real well. Then that disease starts picking up steam. And the problem with these lesions is they'll become more and more prolific on the leaf, and eventually the leaf falls off. So for a heavily infested plant, and we have the right weather conditions for this disease organism, over time the leaves fall off and you just got this stem going up. And you might have leaves on the upper canopy, but the lower canopy is somewhat empty. And the problem with that is, one, you know, it captures the sunlight, it produces sugars that go into the fruit, but now the fruit is not covered by leaves. And so if these fruit are exposed to the sun for couple hours, then your fruit gets sunburned, and so you just don't have that nice red looking tomato.
You know, I haven't had that problem, but I am recalling somebody who did. I can actually picture what you were talking about. I'm trying to remember who it was, but they had this problem with the whole thing was just like the canopy at the top, bare plant, and the tomatoes were worthless that year.
Well,
person.
I'll send you some pictures of several of these issues, blossom end rot, septorial leaf spot, and early blight. So you can post them, and your viewers or listeners can take a look at them and see if they've got that going on in their garden.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, horticulture educator Tom Butzler, is with Penn State Cooperative Extension. And something that he wanted to talk about was Japanese beetles. And if I can just digress and tell you a story about my little fight with the little buggers,
sure.
Because, I mean, they're beautiful. They look like jewelry or something, and or buttons on a fancy shirt. But, boy, they're a pain in the neck, especially if you have rose bushes. They will decimate them. And my dad had a whole bunch of rose bushes. Now, he had passed away, and my mother's got the property. And she's saying, well, what can we do? What can we do? I said, well, let me do some research. And I talked to somebody. Oh, you got to get these Japanese beetle traps. I says, will this actually do it? No, you got to get these Japanese beetle traps, and they'll all go into the trap, and they'll leave your rose bushes alone. And me being the trusting soul I am, I go get the Japanese beetle traps, which work wonderfully, except even though it's all the way down toward the back of the yard, and we're not talking an estate here. We're talking just a typical backyard, but it was long. You can smell them on a warm day.
Yes.
As they're dying in there. And apparently, if you have Japanese beetle traps with dying Japanese beetles, it attracts thousands more of the buggers.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
Yeah, that is. I mean, kind of the running joke is if you want to use one of those traps to attract Japanese beetles if you want to use one of those traps, that you should set them up in your neighbor's yard, because you are right. I mean, they do work, and that they do attract Japanese beetles, but all those ones that are out there, you know, picking up those chemical scents from the trap, they're not going to all end up in the trap. They're going to end up on your rose bush, Doug. So, that's kind of a running gag. They are somewhat effective in attracting Japanese beetle. But as a level of control, no, that really doesn't work. So, there are a couple options to that Japanese beetle management, and none of them are great. But one of them is if you just have a single rose bush, Doug, one of the things you could do is just go out in the morning, just knock them off in a bucket of soapy water. And, that they just drown. So, I mean, that could be just a morning task before the heat and humidity picks up.
They'll drown, but they'll be very clean.
What's that? Yeah, right. The other thing is, you know, if it's affecting some of your vegetable plants, you can get some of these row covers. Remay row covers, they're very lightweight. And basically, you're just creating a barrier. And I think I've talked about this in the past.
I've seen those. I've seen some neighbors that have those.
Yeah. And so, that's a pesticide-free control method. You're just trying to create a barrier between the plant and anything that's flying around that is, you know, looking for dinner. That's one way to do it. They're lightweight, and it doesn't really block out too much sun. And then even if it blocks out a little bit, it's providing some shade, and that provides some alleviation to heat stress. There is the chemical approach. There are some synthetic chemicals that are very good. And then there's some organic options such as neem oil that give you a little bit of control. It's more of a suppression. It might knock the population back a little bit or deter feeding for a little bit, but it's not as effective as some of these synthetic options. So, yeah, that's really about it. And it affects more plant. Let me back up a second. It affects some plant species more than others. So, you mentioned rose bushes in the landscape. My sassafras tree, every time we get a bad infestation, Japanese beetles, I mean, they go to town on it.
Oy.
And for your listeners, it's not eating the trunk. It's not boring into the trunk. It just feeds on the leaves, and it basically eats all the green material on the leaf. And you're left with just these veins.
Yeah.
In the garden, I've seen it do a pretty good number on beans. They really like beans. So, just keep an eye on in the landscape and see what they're feeding on. And depends on the value of that plant. If it is a rose bush that you take cuttings off of for, cut flowers, maybe you use that cover or maybe you use one of the chemicals. Otherwise, you just kind of let them do their thing. I've never really seen them kill a plant, but... Yeah.
They probably made a few plants that I've had wish they were dead, though, quite frankly, for what they did to them, especially the rose bushes. Now, there was a type of insecticidal soap that I got, and I was using it mainly due to spider mites on a rose bush that I used to have before I moved.
Yeah.
And I thought, I better take this along because the new property has a rose bush. This rose bush, as far as I can tell, not one Japanese beetle, not any spider mites. And, we're talking maybe, a couple of miles apart from where I was. So it's amazing to me how you can have a problem in just one section and then you move not that far away. You've got the same type of plant, not the same plant, but the same type of plant. And it doesn't seem to attract it.
How long have you been at this location?
About 3 years.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, Japanese beetles aren't bad every single year, but 3 years should have been enough time to, get one of those like big buildups. So it could be one of these old fashioned roses or something about it that's just not as tasty. I mean, when you look at different rose bushes or different types of oaks and so forth, they have insects prefer one over the other. So there might be something there on that.
By the way, if you have a rose bush, and I did not plant it, if you have a rose bush that is a climbing rose, is it better to prune it back or just get a trellis and let it have its day?
Well, I guess I'm of the, I'm of the opinion I come from right plant for the right place. And so if you're buying a climbing rose, it's been bred, designed, evolved, or whatever, to be a large plant and to grow. And so that's a plant that I would rather have on some sort of a trellis system. I mean, sure, you could prune it back, but I think you're going to lose some of its prolific flowering if you try to keep it in shape, not ground level, but, at chest high or, 6 feet high. But, yeah, I mean, you certainly can prune it. That wouldn't be hard to do.
Yeah, I've been doing that simply because it's in the middle of nowhere. It's nothing for it to climb on. I'd have to go get a trellis, which I could do. And I've been considering because the more I'd prune it back, it does get bushy for a while and it does get more roses down below. But then it just shoots up like crazy if we get decent rain.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, it gets two different types of roses on it simply because I'm guessing either it was a graft on the roots and part of the roots grew up, or they put two rose bushes together and they really shouldn't have crowded them together like that into what looks like one plant. But it's funny to see two different colors on the same bush or what looks like the same bush. It's not really.
That's interesting. I have never seen that, but certainly a possibility, what you alluded to on the grafting thing, because you can buy fruit trees, you've seen them in catalogs and everything, where you can get a couple different types of apples on one tree. And so what they've done is grafted them onto a rootstock, and, you know, they usually take pretty easily. So, yeah, that's certainly not out of the realm of possibility, what you're seeing there.
Well, what had happened, and I think that they just put the two plants together, that's not exactly what happened here. But the funny thing is, some years ago, where I used to live, I had this one particular rose bush. We had a particularly bad winter, and I thought it was dead and gone. So I, you know, cut it back and everything, and I was going to try to figure out what to do with it. Well, while I'm not touching the ground, suddenly these shoots come up. It had been one of these roses with no thorns. What grew up was a similar color, but not exactly the same, and it did have thorns. So the root was still alive, although the plant had it was dead wood. There was no way that was coming back, the grafted part. But the roots lived just fine under the surface.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting observation. So for your listeners there, this sounds like it was a grafted rose, something that was very beautiful at the top portion, and it was a different type of root, different rose root, and they grafted that. And what happened is that top portion died, and there was a bud right below that graft union on the rootstock that just, you know, the plant wants to survive. And so it saw that it didn't have any top growth, so it sent up that bud. And, yeah, you're seeing the plants originate from the rootstock, not from the what we call the scion, and that's the upper portion.
Why do some people use that? I'm guessing because those particular roots are stronger than the root that goes with the plant that's been grafted into it. Is that close?
Yeah, so there's a lot of reasons why, you know, people are grafting, and that could be a show in itself. But briefly, you know, there's some sort of advantage in using a different rootstock other than the top portion of the plant as the root. And so let's just look at apple trees as an example. So, you know, when you look at apple tree production over history, you know, people would have to get ladders and climb trees to go pick those apples. But there are some apple varieties, species, that are small. They're dwarfing, but they produce terrible apples. So what they did was they took some of these apple trees that produced small trees and used the root and then grafted their favorable apple variety, whatever anyone liked, and grafted it onto this rootstock that made the upper portion grow small. It might only allow that upper portion to grow 6 feet, 7 feet. And so now you no longer need a ladder because we're using these dwarfing rootstocks that limit the amount of top growth on this scion wood. So, you know, that's just one example. In watermelon production or in, tomato production, there are a lot of diseases that occur, microorganisms that live in the soil. And if you're just using a regular tomato plant, for example, it's very susceptible to these soil-borne diseases. But there are some tomatoes that are resistant to it, but they produce terrible tomatoes. So if you can take the advantage of these roots that are resistant to the microorganisms and take the top portion of a plant that just produces beautiful tomatoes, combine them, then you get the benefit of both. You get the disease-resistant rootstock, and you get the upper portion with producing beautiful tomatoes. So there are a lot of different reasons that we do this grafting. Those are just two examples, but it just aids in improved production.
It's WRTA Weekend. Doug Herendeen, Tom Butler from Penn State Cooperative Extension, horticulture educator. And he said he wanted to talk about two things here while we've got one final segment. His failure to control weeds, and that was me when I wouldn't weed enough when I was a kid. My dad said, get out there and do it again. And your garden disaster as deer help themselves to the buffet. Which do you wish to start with?
Well, it's actually a story, Doug, because the whole gardening season has been a disaster. So let me just go back a little bit, because you hear growers or gardeners talking about their gardens and not, you know, all the problems they have. And this year, it's been like a perfect storm for me. So I like to start a lot of my plants, and I have a little miniature greenhouse, one you put up and you take down. And I put a heater in it, to keep it warm during the early part of the season in March and April. And I had been starting my cauliflower, my lettuce, and my broccoli, and all these different things. I had trays and trays of vegetable plants. Well, we got that cold spell that came in. Remember March? I think it was like March 20th.
Oh, yeah.
And I had heaters in there, but I guess the heaters were working so hard that they tripped. And so we had that cold spell. It was like 19 degrees. Everything in that little greenhouse, almost everything, froze. I can't believe how much I lost. All right, so that's a failure. Life goes on. So we go into the growing season. I started new plants, and there are some things I start later anyway, so it didn't matter as much. So here I am in the garden. I put time and effort into the garden, and two things just kind of in the past couple weeks have just, I guess, almost makes me want to throw up my hands and just
wait till next year.
Yeah. So the first one is I had rows and rows of lettuce. I had kale. I had beans. I had so many different types of vegetable crops in the garden. I went away for a week because I went to this national conference. One of them was, to get some of these awards. Also, it's just professional improvement. But I came back, and everything was eaten down to the ground. I mean, my wife's kind of making fun of me. We got this issue with food safety with lettuce. You've heard this, the diarrhea that's occurring with eating all this lettuce that's infected with, I think, cyclospora. And it wouldn't be a problem if I had my rows and rows of lettuce, but I don't have any lettuce. I got to go buy lettuce. But yeah, the deer came in, and normally I don't have a problem with them. So this winter, one of my off-season projects is going to be putting up a fence. Just what I need, Doug. More work, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the deer will sit there and go, watch me clear that in 2 seconds flat.
I know. So we're going to have to – I'll have to figure something out. So I never really had to worry about deer too much. Every once in a while they came in, but I don't know. They found it. They told their friends or whatever it is.
Well, they saw the newspapers pile up on the front porch and said, oh, dinner. And by the way, lest anybody think, Tom must be living out in Timbuktu. It doesn't affect me. I have been in suburban city streets of Altoona and encountered deer. Either crossing or just standing there looking at me like, what? I'm not allowed here?
Yeah.
So, they're everywhere.
Yeah. So that was one thing. And then the other thing, Doug, I guess you got to practice what you preach, but the weeds got ahead of me this year. So I use mulch, but there were some areas of the garden I didn't mulch or I didn't put it as tight around some of the plants. And you had some of these weeds escape. And so if you stay on top of weeding, it's somewhat manageable. But it's the busy growing season. I work with commercial vegetable growers. I'm out and about a lot. It's 95 degrees. Last thing I want to do is go into the garden and weed. So that kept me out of the garden a couple days. And then I go away for 8 days to this conference in Denver, Colorado. And so any weeds that were somewhat small – do you know how fast weeds can grow in a week's time?
Well, we talked about just the dandelions after a good soaking rain in one day. So, I imagine the weeds. I've had the same problem. Yeah.
Yeah, I come back. I walk up to the garden and say, see how it is. First of all, there's hardly any vegetables because the deer have eaten everything. And the only thing that's kind of showing any green are these waist-high weeds. And so I spent the past, 2 days in 95-degree weather, which I didn't want to be doing, out there weeding my garden. And so, I tell people, mulch to control weeds and do it on a regular basis so you're not out there in the middle of summer. And here I am, weeding in the middle of summer when it's stinking hot.
Well, to all of us who have had these frustrations, it's nice to know that the experts can have problems too.
Yeah. So, but there is some satisfaction, though. Here it is, Doug. I pull up these weeds. I shake off some of the dirt, most of it. And then I throw the weeds on a mulch or just in the center of the aisle of the vegetable garden because they'll decompose. I come back a day later, and they are so dried down. It makes me feel good seeing that those weeds desiccating in the garden. A little bit of vengeance, I guess.
Die, weeds.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's something. The deer and the weeds just got onto me, and then you add in that freeze event we had in March, and it's just been bad.
Yeah, why is it the deer never eat the weeds?
That's what I was thinking too. I'm just not as tasty.
I guess not.
If there was nothing else to eat. No, I did buy some product. You know, you can buy some wildlife deterrent stuff out there that, you know, deters rabbits and deer from eating. And it does work a little bit or initially. But the problem, and research has shown this, is that, one, they get used to it, that smell. And so they'll venture back into the garden. And then, two, after a rain event, it's no longer effective. And so you got to stay on top of that. You got to apply it on a regular basis. So even if you apply it on a regular basis, you know, you get out there every other day, they're eventually going to get used to it. But I was away for, you know, almost what, 8 days. And you know, we had some a rain event and washed away. So I guess that also allowed the deer to come into the garden.
Yeah, I have a fence, but, you know, big deal, the deer isn't going to care. But I had a perennial that I planted a couple summers ago, and it got to a certain height, and then I come out one day, and it's half the height. And yeah. I know it's not the rabbits that live under the shed, and because they didn't eat it down to the ground, it was like something was leaning over the fence and chewing on that. And, well, luckily it grew back.
Here's what it is, Doug. You know, you talked about your climbing rose and should you prune it. Your deer are wandering around, the deer in your neighborhood are wandering around their property, and they're looking for homeowners that do poor pruning practices. So they probably saw something and thought, hey, Doug, we're going to prune this for you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And again, if you think that there ain't deer, and it's amazing when you're driving around at night and you're in the city of Altoona, not, you know, okay, this is the suburbs or whatever, and you go by and right there on the lawn, oh, that's not a ceramic deer. That's a real deer. It moves.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yep. No, they love the urban area. There's no predators there except maybe cars. But other than that.
Yeah. some people think the deer are the predators when it comes to their cars.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
I remember going through Jersey on 80 one time, and the deer went diagonally across from me, and I swear we did not make contact, but I'm thinking there's fur on the front bumper.
At
the very least, it was that close. And that was back before airbags. So, you know, you'll have this. Tom Butler.
Oh, you go up and down the highways, Doug, and there's just deer carcasses all over the place.
Yeah. I don't envy anybody who has to clean that up in the hot weather from this summer. Before we go, if people want to get in touch with you.
Yeah, so you can call my office at the Clinton County Extension office, and that number is 570-726-0022. But I prefer emails because a lot of times you got a problem or a question, and I like to see pictures. It allows me to hear you verbally but also look at the picture of the issue you're having. So send me an email at tmb124@psu.edu.
Tom Butler, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Doug.